Chapter 4. Rustenburg, Germany, January 1944. Rear Admiral Wilhelm Franz Canaris was a small, nervous man who spoke with a slight lisp and possessed a sarcastic wit on those rare occasions when he chose to display it. White-haired, with piercing blue eyes, he was seated in the back of a staff Mercedes as it rumbled from the Rustenburg airfield to Hitler's secret bunker 9 miles away. Usually Canaris shunned uniforms and martial trappings of any kind, preferring a dark business suit instead. But since he was about to meet with Adolf Hitler and the most senior military officers in Germany, he was wearing his Kriegsmarine uniform beneath his formal greatcoat. Known as the Old Fox by friends and detractors alike, Canaris's detached, aloof personality suited him perfectly to the ruthless world of espionage. He cared more about his two Dachshunds, sleeping now on the floor at his feet, than anyone except his wife, Erika, and his daughters. When work mandated overnight travel, he booked a separate room with double beds, so the dogs could sleep in comfort. When it was necessary to leave them behind in Berlin, Canaris checked in with his aides constantly to make certain the animals had eaten and had proper bowel movements. Abwehr staff, who dared to speak ill of the dogs, faced the very real threat of having their careers destroyed if word of their treachery ever reached Canaris's ears. Raised in a walled villa in the Dortmund suburb of Upplerbeck, as a member of the German elite so detested by Adolf Hitler, Wilhelm Canaris was the son of a chimney baron and descendant of Italians who emigrated to Germany in the 16th century. He spoke the languages of Germany's friends as well as her enemies, Italian, Spanish, English, French, and Russian, and regularly presided over recitals of chamber music in the salon of his stately Berlin home. In 1933, he was serving as commander of a naval depot on the Baltic Sea at Swinemünde, when Hitler unexpectedly chose him to head the Abwehr, the Intelligence and Counter-Espionage Service. Hitler commanded his new spymaster to create a secret service on the British model, an order doing its work with passion. And Canaris formally took control of the spy agency on New Year's Day 1934, his 47th birthday. The decision would prove to be one of Hitler's worst. Since taking command of the Abwehr, Wilhelm Canaris had been engaged in an extraordinary high-wire act, providing the German General Staff with the intelligence it needed to conquer most of Europe, while at the same time using the service as a tool to rid Germany of Hitler. He was a leader of the resistance movement dubbed the Black Orchestra, Schwarze Kapelle, by the Gestapo, a tightly knit group of German military officers, government officials, and civic leaders. The Black Orchestra had tried unsuccessfully to overthrow the Führer and negotiate a peace settlement with the Allies. Canaris had engaged in other treasonous activities as well. In 1939, after learning of Hitler's plans to invade Poland, he warned the British in a futile attempt to spur them into action. He did the same in 1940 when Hitler announced plans to invade the Low Countries and France. Canaris turned and peered out the window, watching as the forest swept past, dark, silent, heavily wooded, like the setting of a fairy tale by the Brothers Grimm. Lost in the quiet of the snow-covered trees, he thought of the most recent attempt on the Führer's life. 2 months earlier, in November, a young captain named Axel von dem Buscher volunteered to assassinate Hitler during an inspection of a new Wehrmacht greatcoat. Buscher planned to conceal several grenades beneath the coat, then detonate them during the demonstration, killing himself and the Führer. But one day before the assassination attempt, Allied bombers destroyed the building where the coats were housed. The demonstration was cancelled, never to be rescheduled. Canaris knew there would be more attempts, more brave Germans willing to sacrifice their own lives in order to rid Germany of Hitler. But he also knew time was running out. The Anglo-American invasion of Europe was a certainty. Roosevelt had made it clear he would accept nothing short of unconditional surrender. Germany would be destroyed, just as Canaris feared back in 1933, when Hitler's messianic ambitions became clear to him. He also realized his tenuous grip on the Abwehr was growing weaker by the day. Several members of Canaris's executive staff at Abwehr headquarters in Berlin had been arrested by the Gestapo and charged with treason. His enemies were plotting to seize control of the spy agency and put his neck in a noose of piano wire. He understood his days were numbered, that his long and dangerous high-wire act was nearing an end. The staff car passed through a myriad of gates and checkpoints, then turned into the compound at Hitler's Wolfschanze, the wolf's lair. The Dachshunds awakened, whimpering nervously, and jumped onto his lap. The conference was to be held in the frigid, airless map room in the underground bunker. Canaris climbed out of the car and walked morosely across the compound. At the bottom of the stairs, a burly SS bodyguard stood with hand out to relieve Canaris of any weapons he might be carrying. Canaris, who shunned firearms and detested violence, shook his head and brushed past.
"In November, I issued Führer Directive No. 51.
Hitler began without preamble, pacing the room violently, hands clasped behind his back. He wore a dove-grey tunic, black trousers, and resplendent knee-length jackboots. On his left breast pocket he wore the iron cross he earned at Ypres, while serving as an infantryman in the List Regiment in the First War.
Directive No. 51 stated my belief that the Anglo-Saxons will attempt to invade northwest France no later than the spring, perhaps earlier. During the last 2 months, I have seen nothing to change my opinion.
Canaris, seated at the conference table, watched the Führer prancing around the room. Hitler's pronounced stoop, caused by a kyphotic spine, seemed to have worsened. Canaris wondered if he was finally feeling the pressure. He should be. What was it Frederick the Great had said? He who defends everything defends nothing. Hitler should have heeded the advice of his spiritual guide, for Germany was in the same position she had been in during the Great War. She had conquered far more territory than she could possibly defend. It was Hitler's own fault, the damned fool. Canaris glanced up at the map. In the east, German troops were fighting along a 2,000-kilometer front. Any hope of a military victory over the Russians had been crushed the previous July at Kursk, where the Red Army had decimated the Wehrmacht offensive and inflicted staggering casualties. Now the German army was attempting to hold a line stretching from Leningrad to the Black Sea. Along the Mediterranean, Germany was defending 3,000 kilometers of coastline, and in the west, my God, Canaris thought, 6,000 kilometers of territory stretching from the Netherlands to the southern tip of the Bay of Biscay. Hitler's Festung Europa, Fortress Europe, was far-flung and vulnerable on all sides. Canaris looked around the table at the men seated with him. Field Marshal Gerd von Rundstedt, commander-in-chief of all German forces in the west, Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, commander of Army Group B in northwest France, Reichsführer Heinrich Himmler, head of the SS and chief of the German police. A half-dozen of Himmler's most loyal and ruthless men stood watch, just in case any of the top brass of the Third Reich decided to make an attempt on the Führer's life. Hitler stopped pacing.
Directive 51 also stated my belief that we can no longer justify reducing our troop levels in the west in order to support our forces battling the Bolsheviks. In the east, the vastness of space will, as a last resort, permit us to give up vast amounts of territory before the enemy threatens the German homeland. Not so in the west. If the Anglo-Saxon invasion succeeds, the consequences will be disastrous. So it is here, in northwest France, where the most decisive battle of the war will be fought.
Hitler paused, allowing his words to sink in.
The invasion will be met with the full fury of our might and destroyed at the high water mark. If that is not possible, and if the Anglo-Saxons succeed in securing a temporary beachhead, we must be prepared to rapidly deploy our forces, stage a massive counterattack, and hurl the invaders back into the sea.
Hitler crossed his arms.
But to achieve that goal, we must know the enemy's order of battle. We must know when he intends to strike. And more importantly, where? Herr Generalfeldmarschall?
Field Marshal Gerd von Rundstedt rose and wearily moved to the map, right hand clutching the jeweled field marshal's baton he carried at all times. Known as the last of the German knights, Rundstedt had been dismissed and recalled to duty by Adolf Hitler more times than Canaris or even his own staff could remember. Detesting the fanatical world of the Nazis, it was Rundstedt who had derisively christened Hitler the little Bohemian corporal. The strain of 5 long years of war was beginning to show on the narrow, aristocratic features of his face. Gone were the stiff, precise mannerisms that characterized the general staff officers of the imperial days. Canaris knew Rundstedt drank more champagne than he should, and needed large quantities of whiskey to sleep at night. He regularly rose at the thoroughly unmilitary hour of 10 o'clock in the morning. The staff at his headquarters at Saint-Germain-en-Laye rarely scheduled meetings before noon. Despite his advancing years and moral decline, Rundstedt was still Germany's finest soldier, a brilliant tactician and strategic thinker, as he demonstrated to the Poles in 1939 and to the French and British in 1940. Canaris did not envy Rundstedt's situation. On paper, he presided over a large and powerful force in the West, 1.5 million men, including 350,000 crack Waffen-SS troops, 10 Panzer divisions, and 2 elite Fallschirmjäger paratroop divisions. If deployed quickly and correctly, Rundstedt's armies were still capable of dealing the Allies a devastating defeat. But if the old Teutonic Knight guessed wrong, if he deployed his forces incorrectly or made tactical blunders once the battle had begun, the Allies would establish their precious foothold on the continent, and the war in the West would be lost.
"In my opinion, the equation is simple," Rundstedt began. "East of the Seine at the Pas-de-Calais or west of the Seine at Normandy, each has its advantages and disadvantages."
"Go on, Herr Generalfeldmarschall."
Rundstedt continued in a dull monotone.
"Calais is the strategic linchpin of the Channel coast. If the enemy secures a beachhead at Calais, he can turn to the east and be a few days' march from the Ruhrgebiet, our industrial heartland. The Americans want the war to be over by Christmas. If they succeed in a landing at Calais, they might get their wish."
Rundstedt paused to allow his warning to sink in, then resumed his briefing.
"There's another reason why Calais makes sense militarily. The channel is the narrowest there. The enemy will be able to pour men and materiel into Calais 4 times faster than he would at Normandy or Brittany. Remember, the clock is ticking for the enemy the moment the invasion begins. He must build up troops, weapons, and supplies at an extremely rapid rate. There are 3 excellent deep-water ports in the Pas-de-Calais area."
Rundstedt tapped each with the tip of his baton, moving up the coastline.
"Boulogne, Calais, and Dunkirk. The enemy needs ports. It is my belief that the first goal of the invaders will be to seize a major port and reopen it as quickly as possible, for without a major port, the enemy cannot supply his troops. If he cannot supply his troops, he is dead."
"Impressive, Herr Generalfeldmarschall," Hitler said. "But why not Normandy?"
"Normandy presents the enemy with many problems. The distance across the channel is much greater. At some points, high cliffs stand between the beaches and the mainland. The closest harbor is Cherbourg, at the tip of a heavily defended peninsula. It might be days before the enemy could take Cherbourg from us, and even if he did, he knows we would render it useless before surrendering it. But the most logical argument against a strike at Normandy, in my opinion, is its geographic location. It is too far to the west. Even if the enemy succeeds in landing at Normandy, he runs the risk of being pinned down and strategically isolated. He must fight us all the way across France before even reaching German soil."
"Your opinion, Herr Generalfeldmarschall?"
Hitler snapped.
"Perhaps the Allies will engage in some trickery,"
Rundstedt said cautiously, fingers working over the baton.
"A diversionary landing, perhaps, as you yourself have suggested, my Führer. But the real strike will come here."
He jabbed at the map.
"At Calais."
"Admiral Canaris?"
Hitler asked.
"What kind of intelligence do you have to support that theory?"
Canaris, not one for formal displays at the map, remained seated. He reached into the breast pocket of his coat, where he kept a pack of cigarettes. The SS men flinched nervously. Canaris, shaking his head, slowly withdrew the cigarettes and displayed them. He laboriously lit one and blew a stream of smoke toward Himmler, knowing full well the Reichsfuhrer's pet peeve about tobacco. Himmler glared at him through the swirling pall of blue smoke, eyes betraying no emotion, the side of his face twitching nervously. Canaris explained that the Abwehr was collecting and analyzing three types of intelligence connected with the invasion preparations. Aerial photographs of enemy troops in southern England, enemy wireless communications monitored by the Funk Abwehr, the agency's listening service, and reports from agents operating inside Britain.
"And what is that intelligence telling you, Herr Admiral?"
Hitler snapped.
"Our initial intelligence tends to support the Field Marshal's assessment that the Allies intend to strike at Calais. According to our agents, there has been increased enemy activity in southeast England, directly across the channel from the Pas de Calais. We have monitored wireless transmissions referring to a new force called the 1st United States Army Group. We have also been analyzing the enemy's air activity over northwest France. He is spending far more time over Calais for the purposes of bombing and reconnaissance than over Normandy or Brittany. I have one other piece of new information to report, my Führer. One of our agents in England has a source inside the Allied High Command. Last night the agent transmitted a report. General Eisenhower has arrived in London. The Americans and British intend to keep his presence secret for the time being."
Hitler seemed impressed by the agent's report. If only Hitler knew the truth, Canaris thought. But now, just months before the most important battle of the war, the Abwehr's intelligence networks in England were very likely in tatters. Canaris blamed Hitler. During the preparations for Operation Seelöwe, the aborted invasion of Britain, Canaris and his staff recklessly poured spies into England. All caution was thrown to the wind because of the desperate need for intelligence on coastal defences and British troop positions. Agents were hastily recruited, poorly trained, and even more poorly equipped. Canaris suspected most walked straight into the arms of MI5, inflicting permanent damage on networks that took years of painstaking work to build. He could not admit that now. To do so would be to sign his own death warrant. Adolf Hitler was pacing again. Canaris knew Hitler did not fear the coming invasion. Quite the opposite, he welcomed it. He had 10 million Germans under arms and an armaments industry that, despite relentless Allied bombing and shortages of labor and raw material, continued to produce staggering amounts of weapons and supplies. He remained confident of his ability to repel the invasion and hand the Allies a cataclysmic defeat. Like Rundstedt, he believed a landing at the Pas de Calais made strategic sense, and it was there that his Atlantikwall most resembled his vision of an impregnable fortress. In effect, Hitler had tried to force the Allies to invade at Calais by ordering the launching sites for his V-1 and V-2 rockets to be placed there. Yet Hitler was also aware the British and Americans had engaged in deception throughout the war, and would do so again as a prelude to the invasion of France.
"Let us reverse the roles," Hitler finally said. "If I were going to invade France from England, what would I do? Would I come by the obvious route, the route my enemy expects me to take? Would I stage a frontal assault on the most heavily defended portion of the coastline? Or would I take another route and attempt to surprise my enemy? Would I broadcast false wireless messages and send false reports through spies? Would I make misleading statements to the press? The answer to all these questions is yes. We must expect the British to engage in deception and even a major diversionary landing. As much as I would wish them to attempt a landing at Calais, we must be prepared for the possibility of an invasion at Normandy or Brittany. Therefore, our panzers must remain safely back from the coast until the enemy's intentions are clear. Then we will concentrate our armor at the main point of the attack and hurl them back into the sea."
"There is one other thing to take into account that might support your argument," Field Marshal Erwin Rommel said. Hitler spun on his heel to face him.
"Go on, Herr Generalsfeldmarschall."
Rommel gestured at the large floor-to-ceiling map behind Hitler.
"If you would permit a demonstration, my Führer."
"Of course."
Rommel reached inside his briefcase, removed a pair of calipers, and walked to the map. In December, Hitler had ordered him to assume command of Army Group B along the Channel coast. Army Group B included the 7th Army in the Normandy area, the 15th Army between the Seine estuary and the Zuider Zee, and the Army of the Netherlands. Physically and psychologically recovered from his disastrous defeats in North Africa, the famed Desert Fox had thrown himself into his new assignment with an incredible display of energy, dashing about the French coast in his Mercedes 230 cabriolet at all hours, inspecting his coastal defences and the disposition of his troops and armour. He had promised to turn the French coastline into a devil's garden, a landscape of artillery, minefields, concrete fortifications and barbed wire from which the enemy would never emerge. Yet privately, Rommel believed any fortification devised by man could be defeated by man. Standing before the map, Rommel pulled open the calipers. "This represents the range of the enemy's Spitfire and Mustang fighter planes. These are the locations of major fighter bases in the south of England." He placed one end of the calipers on each of the sites and drew a series of arcs on the map. "As you can see, my Führer, both Normandy and Calais are well within range of the enemy's fighters. Therefore, we must regard both areas as possible sites for the invasion." Hitler nodded, impressed by Rommel's display. "Place yourself in the enemy's position for a moment, Herr Generalfeldmarschall. If you were attempting to invade France from England, where would you strike?" Rommel made a brief show of thought, then said, "I must admit, my Führer, that all signs point to an invasion at the Pas-de-Calais. But I cannot rid myself of the belief that the enemy would never attempt a frontal assault on our strongest concentration of forces. I am also tainted by the experience of Africa. The British engaged in deception before the Battle of Alamein, and they will do so again before an invasion of France." "And the best of all, Herr Generalfeldmarschall, how is the work proceeding?" "Much to be done, my Führer. But we are making good progress." "Will it be done before spring?" "I believe so. But coastal fortifications alone cannot stop the enemy. We need to have our armor arrayed properly. And for that, I'm afraid we need to know where they plan to strike. Nothing short of that will be of any use. If the enemy succeeds, the war may be lost."
"Nonsense," Heinrich Himmler said. "Under the Führer, Germany's ultimate victory is beyond question. The beaches of France will be a graveyard for the British and the Americans."
"No," Hitler said, waving his hand. "Rommel is correct. If the enemy is able to secure a beachhead, the war is lost. But if we destroy the invasion before it ever gets started..."
Hitler's head tilted back, eyes blazing.
"It would take months to organize another attempt. The enemy would never try again. Roosevelt would never be re-elected. He might even end up in jail somewhere. British morale would collapse overnight. Churchill, that sick, fat old man, would be destroyed. With the Americans and the British paralyzed, licking their wounds, we can take men and material from the West and pour them into the East. Stalin will be at our mercy. He will sue for peace. Of this I am certain."
Hitler paused, allowing his words to sink in.
"But if the enemy is to be stopped, we must know the location of the invasion," he said. "My generals think it will be Calais. I'm skeptical."
He spun on his heel and glared at Canaris.
"Herr Admiral, I want you to settle the argument."
"That may not be possible," Canaris said carefully.
"Is it not the task of the Abwehr to provide military intelligence?"
"Of course, my Führer."
"You have spies operating inside Britain. This report about General Eisenhower's arrival in London is proof of that."
"Obviously, my Führer."
"Then I suggest you get to work, Herr Admiral. I want proof of the enemy's intentions. I want you to bring me the secret of the invasion, and quickly. Let me assure you, you don't have much time."
Hitler paled visibly and seemed suddenly exhausted.
"Now, unless you gentlemen have any more bad news for me, I'm going to get a few hours of sleep. It's been a very long night."
They all rose as Hitler walked up the stairs. Chapter 5. Northern Spain, August 1936. He is standing before the doors, open to the warm night, holding a bottle of icy white wine. He pours himself another glass without offering to refill hers. She is lying on the bed, smoking, listening to his voice, listening to the warm wind stirring the trees off the veranda. Heat lightning is flickering silently over the valley. His valley, as he always says. My fucking valley. And if the motherfucking loyalists ever try to take it from me, I'll cut off their fucking balls and feed them to the dogs.
Who taught you to shoot like that?
He demands. They went hunting in the morning, and she has taken 4 pheasant to his 1.
My father?
You shoot better than me.
So I've noticed.
The lightning is quietly in the room again, and she can see Emilio clearly for a few seconds. He is 30 years older, yet she thinks he is beautiful. His hair is grey-blonde. The sun has made his face the color of oiled saddle leather. His nose is long and sharp, an axe blade. She wanted to be kissed by his lips, but he wanted her very fast and rough the first time, and Emilio always gets what he fucking wants, darling.
You speak English very well,
he informs her, as if she is hearing this for the first time.
Your accent is perfect. I could never lose mine, no matter how hard I tried.
My mother was English.
Where is she now?
She died a long time ago.
You have French as well?
Yes,
she answers.
Italian?
Yes, I have Italian.
Your Spanish is not so good, though.
Good enough, she says.
He is fingering his cock while he speaks. He loves it like he loves his money and his land. He speaks of it as though it is one of his finest horses. In bed, it is like a third person.
You lie with Maria by the stream. Then at night, you let me come to your bed and fuck you, he says.
That's one way of putting it, she answers. Do you want me to stop with Maria?
You make her happy, he says, as if happiness is grounds for anything.
She makes me happy.
I've never known a woman like you before.
He sticks a cigarette into the corner of his mouth and lights it, hands cupped against the evening breeze.
You fuck me and my daughter on the same day without blinking an eye.
I don't believe in forming attachments.
He laughs his quiet, controlled laugh.
That's wonderful, he says, and laughs quietly again. You don't believe in forming attachments. That's marvelous. I pity the poor bastard who makes the mistake of falling in love with you.
So do I.
Do you have any feelings?
No, not really.
Do you love anyone or anything?
I love my father, she says. And I love lying by the stream with Maria.
Maria is the only woman she has ever met whose beauty is a threat to her. She neutralizes that threat by pillaging Maria's beauty for herself. Her mane of brown curly hair, her flawless olive skin, the perfect breasts that are like summer pears in her mouth, the lips that are the softest things she has ever touched.
Come to Spain for the summer and live with me at my family's estancia,
Maria says one rainy afternoon in Paris, where they are both studying at the Sorbonne. Father will be disappointed, but the idea of spending the summer in Germany watching the fucking Nazis parading around the streets holds nothing for her. She did not know she would be walking straight into a civil war instead. But the war does not intrude on Emilio's insolent enclave of paradise in the foothills of the Pyrenees. It is the most wonderful summer of her life. In the morning, the 3 of them hunt or run the dogs, and in the afternoon, she and Maria ride up to the stream, swim in the icy deep pools, sun themselves on the warm rocks. Maria likes it best when they are outside. She likes the sensation of the sun on her breasts, and Anna between her legs.
My father wants you too, you know,
Maria announces one afternoon as they lie in the shade of a eucalyptus tree.
You can have him. Just don't fall in love with him. Everyone is in love with him.
Emilio is talking again.
When you return to Paris next month, there's someone I want you to meet. Will you do that for me?
That depends.
On what?
On who it is.
He will contact you. When I tell him about you, he will be very interested.
I'm not going to sleep with him.
He won't be interested in sleeping with you. He's a family man. Like me,
he adds, and laughs his laugh again. What's his name?
Names are not important to him.
Tell me his name.
I'm not sure which name he's using these days.
What does your friend do?
He deals in information.
He comes back to the bed. Their conversation has aroused him. His cock is hard, and he wants her again right away. He is pushing her legs apart and trying to find his way inside her. She takes him in her hands to help him, then digs her nails into him.
Ah, Anna, my God, not so hard!
Tell me his name.
It's against the rules. I can't.
Tell me, she says, and squeezes him harder.
Fogel,
he mutters.
His name is Kurt Fogel. Jesus Christ!
Berlin, January 1944. The Abwehr had two primary kinds of spies operating against Britain. The S-chain consisted of agents who entered the country, settled under assumed identities, and engaged in espionage. R-chain agents were mainly third country nationals who periodically entered Britain legally, collected intelligence, and reported back to their masters in Berlin. There was a third, a smaller and highly secretive network of spies, referred to as the V-chain, a handful of exceptionally trained sleeper agents who burrowed deeply into English society and waited, sometimes for years, to be activated. It was named for its creator and single control officer, Kurt Fogel. Fogel's modest empire consisted of two rooms on the fourth floor of Abwehr headquarters, located in a pair of dour grey stone townhouses at 74-76 Tirpitz Ufer. The windows overlooked the Tiergarten, the 630-acre park in the heart of Berlin. Once it had been a spectacular view, but months of Allied bombing had left panzer-sized craters in the bridle paths and reduced most of the chestnut and lime trees to blackened stumps. Much of Fogel's office was consumed by a row of locked steel cabinets and a heavy safe. He suspected the clerks in the Abwehr's central registry had been turned by the Gestapo and refused to keep files there. His only assistant, a decorated Wehrmacht lieutenant named Werner Ulbricht, who was maimed fighting the Russians, worked in the anteroom. He kept a pair of Lugers in the top drawer of his desk and had been instructed by Fogel to shoot anyone who entered without permission. Ulbricht had nightmares about mistakenly killing Wilhelm Canaris. Fogel officially held the rank of captain in the Kriegsmarine, but it was only a formality designed to give him the rank necessary to operate in certain quarters. Like his mentor Canaris, he rarely wore a uniform. His wardrobe varied little: an undertaker's charcoal suit, a white shirt, a dark tie. He had iron-grey hair that looked as though he had cut it himself, and the intense gaze of a coffee-house revolutionary. His voice was like a rusty hinge. After nearly a decade of clandestine conversations in cafes, hotel rooms, and bugged offices, it rarely rose above a chapel murmur. Ulbricht, deaf in one ear, constantly struggled to hear him. Fogel's passion for anonymity ran to the absurd. His office contained only one personal item, a portrait of his wife, Gertrude, and his twin girls. He banished them to Gertrude's mother's home in Bavaria when the bombing started and saw them infrequently. Whenever he left the office, even for a few moments, he removed the portrait from the desktop and locked it away in a drawer. Even his identification badge was a riddle. It contained no picture. He had refused to be photographed for years, and the name was false. He kept a small flat near the office, reached by a pleasant walk along the leafy banks of the Landwehr Canal, for those rare nights when he permitted himself to escape. His landlady believed he was a college professor with a lot of girlfriends. Even inside the Abwehr, little else was known of him. Kurt Fogel was born in Düsseldorf. His father was the principal of a local school, his mother a part-time music teacher who gave up a promising career as a concert pianist to marry and raise a family. Fogel earned a doctorate of law from Leipzig University, where he studied civil and political law under two of the greatest legal minds in Germany, Hermann Heller and Leo Rosenberg. He was a brilliant student, the top of his class, and his professors quietly predicted Fogel would one day sit on the Reichsgericht, Germany's supreme court. Hitler changed all that. Hitler believed in the rule of men, not the rule of law.
Within months of taking power, he turned Germany's entire judicial system upside down. Führergewalt, Führer power, became the absolute law of the land, and Hitler's every maniacal whim was immediately translated into codes and regulations. Fogel remembered some of the ridiculous maxims coined by the architects of Hitler's legal overhaul of Germany. Law is what is useful to the German people. Law must be interpreted through healthy folk emotions. When the normal judiciary stood in their way, the Nazis established their own courts, Volksgerichtshof, the people's courts. In Fogel's opinion, the darkest day in the history of German jurisprudence came in October 1933, when 10,000 lawyers stood on the steps of the Reichsgericht in Leipzig, arms raised in a Nazi salute, and swore to follow the course of the Führer to the end of our days. Fogel had been among them. That night he went home to the small flat he shared with Gertrude, burned his law books in the stove, and drank himself sick. Several months later, in the winter of 1934, he was approached by a small Dur man with a pair of Dachshunds, Wilhelm Canaris, the new head of the Abwehr. Canaris asked Fogel if he would be willing to go to work for him. Fogel accepted on one condition, that he not be forced to join the Nazi party, and the following week he vanished into the world of German military intelligence. Officially, he served as Canaris's in-house legal counsel. Unofficially, he was given the task of preparing for the war with Britain that Canaris thought was inevitable. Now Fogel sat at his desk, hunched over a memo, knuckles pressed to his temples. He struggled to concentrate over the noise, the rattle of the old lift as it struggled up and down the well just beyond his wall, the splatter of freezing rain against the windows, the cacophony of car horns that accompanied the Berlin evening rush. He moved his hands from his temples to his ears and pressed until there was silence. The memo had been given to him by Canaris earlier that day, a few hours after the old fox returned from a meeting with Hitler at Rustenburg. Canaris thought it looked promising, and Fogel had to agree. "Hitler wants results, Kurt," Canaris had said, sitting behind his battered antique desk, like an impervious old don, eyes wandering the overflowing bookshelves as though searching for a treasured but long-lost volume. "He wants proof it's Calais or Normandy. Perhaps it's time we brought your little nest of spies into the game." Fogel had read it once, quickly. Now he read it more carefully a second time. Actually, it was more than promising. It was perfect. The opportunity he had been waiting for. When he finished, he looked up and murmured Ulbricht's name several times, as if he were speaking directly into his ear. Finally, receiving no reply, he rose and walked into the anteroom. Ulbricht was cleaning his Lugers.
"Werner, I've been calling you for 5 minutes,
Fogel said, his voice nearly inaudible.
"I'm sorry, Captain, I didn't hear you. I want to see Müller first thing in the morning. Make me an appointment."
"Yes, sir."
"And, Werner, do something about your damned ears. I was shouting at the top of my lungs in there."
The bombers came at midnight, as Fogel dozed fitfully in his office on a stiff camp bed. He swung his legs to the floor, rose, and walked to the window as the aircraft droned overhead. Berlin shuddered as the first fires erupted in the districts of Pankow and Weißensee. Fogel wondered how much more punishment the city could absorb. Vast sections of the capital of the Thousand-Year Reich had already been reduced to rubble. Many of the city's most famous neighborhoods resembled canyons of crushed brick and twisted steel. The lime trees of the Unter den Linden had been scorched, as had many of the once glittering shops and banks lining the broad boulevard. The renowned clock at the Kaiser Wilhelm Memorial Church had been stilled at 7:30 since November, when Allied bombers laid waste to 1,000 acres of Berlin on a single night. The memo ran around in his head while he watched the night raid. Abwehr Berlin, XFU 04658482612, to Canaris, from Müller, date 2 November '43. On 21 October, Captain Dietrich of Asuncion Station debriefed American asset Scorpio in Panama City. "As you know, Scorpio is one of our most important agents in America. He is highly placed in New York financial circles and is well connected in Washington. He is personal friends with many senior officers at both the Departments of War and State. He has met personally with Roosevelt. Throughout the war, his information has been timely and highly accurate. I remind you about the intelligence he supplied to us on the American arms shipments to the British. According to Scorpio, a renowned American engineer named Peter Jordan was recruited by the American Navy last month and dispatched to London to work on a highly secret construction project. Jordan has no previous military experience. Scorpio knows Jordan personally and spoke with him before his departure for London. Scorpio says the project is definitely connected to the enemy's plan to invade France. Jordan is respected for his work on several major American bridge projects. Jordan is a widower. His wife, the daughter of American banker Bratton Lauterbach, was killed in an automobile accident in August 1939. Scorpio believes Jordan is highly vulnerable to approach by a female asset. Jordan is now living alone in the section of London known as Kensington. Scorpio has provided the address of the house, as well as the combination of the safe inside the study. Suggest action. Fogel noticed a wedge of light from the doorway and heard the scrape of Ulbricht's wooden leg against the floor. The bombing disturbed Ulbricht in a way he could not put into words, and Fogel could never understand. Fogel removed his key ring from the desk drawer and went to one of the steel cabinets. The file was inside an unmarked black folder. Returning to his desk, he poured himself a large cognac and opened the cover. It was all there. The photographs, the background material, the performance reports. He didn't need to read it. He had written it himself, and, like the subject, he had the curse of a flawless memory. He turned a few more pages and found the notes he had made after their first meeting in Paris. Beneath it was a copy of the cable sent to him by the man who discovered her, Emilio Romero, a wealthy Spanish landowner, a fascist, a talent spotter for the Abwehr. "She is everything you are looking for. I'd like to keep her for myself, but because I am a friend, I will give her to you. At a reasonable price, of course." The room felt suddenly bone-chillingly cold. He lay down on his army cot and covered himself in a blanket.
"Hitler wants results, Kurt. Perhaps it's time we brought your little nest of spies into the game."
Sometimes he imagined leaving her in place until it was all over, then finding some way of getting her out. But she was perfect for it, of course. She was beautiful, she was intelligent, and her English and her knowledge of British society were faultless. He turned and looked at the photograph of Gertrude and the children. To think that he fantasized giving them up for her. He had been such a fool. He switched off the light. The air raid had ended. The night was a symphony of sirens. He tried to sleep, but it was no good. She was under his skin again.
"Poor Fogel. I've made a shambles of your heart, haven't I?"
The eyes in the photograph of his family were boring into him. It was obscene. Looking at them, remembering her, he stood up, went to his desk, and locked the picture away in his drawer.
"For God's sake, Kurt!" Müller exclaimed as Fogel entered his office the following morning. "Who's cutting your hair these days, my friend? Let me give you the name of the woman who does mine. Maybe she can help you."
Fogel, exhausted from a night of little sleep, sat down and silently regarded the figure before him. Paul Müller was in charge of the Abwehr's intelligence networks in the United States. He was short, tubby, and impeccably dressed in a shiny French suit. His thin hair was oiled and combed straight back from his cherubic face. His tiny mouth was sumptuous and red, like that of a child who has just eaten cherry candy.
"Imagine this! The great Kurt Fogel, here in my office," Müller said through a smirk. "To what do I owe this privilege?"
Fogel was used to the professional jealousy of the other senior staff. Because of the special status of his V-chain network, he was given more money and assets than the other case officers. He was also allowed to poke his nose into their affairs, which made him extremely unpopular within the agency. Fogel removed his copy of Müller's memo from the breast pocket of his jacket and waved it in front of him.
"Tell me about Scorpio," he said.
"So the old man finally circulated my note. Look at the date on the goddamn thing. I gave it to him 2 months ago.
It's been sitting on his desk, gathering dust. That information is like gold. But it goes into the fox's lair and never comes out again.
Müller paused, lit a cigarette, and blew a stream of smoke at the ceiling.
You know, Kurt, sometimes I wonder whose side Canaris is on.
The remark was not unusual these days. Since the arrest of several members of the Abwehr's executive staff on charges of treason, morale at Tirpitz Ufer had sunk to a new low. Fogel sensed that Germany's military intelligence agency was dangerously adrift. He had heard rumors that Canaris had fallen out of favor with Hitler. There were even rumors among the staff that Himmler was plotting to bring down Canaris and place the Abwehr under the control of the SS.
"Tell me about Scorpio,"
Fogel repeated.
"I had dinner with him at the home of an American diplomat."
Müller threw back his round head and stared at the ceiling.
"Before the war, 1937, I believe it was. I'll check his file to make certain. The fellow's German was better than mine. Thought the Nazis were a wonderful bunch of fellows doing great things for Germany. Only thing he hated worse than the Jews was the Bolsheviks. It was like an audition. I recruited him myself the next day. Easiest snare of my career."
"What's his background?"
Müller smiled.
"Investment banking. Ivy League, good contacts in industry, friends with half of Washington. His information on war production has been excellent."
Fogel was folding the memo and putting it back in his pocket.
"His name?"
"Come on, Kurt. He is one of my best agents."
"I want his name."
"This place is like a sieve, you know that. I tell you, everybody knows."
"I want a copy of his file on my desk in an hour,"
Fogel said, his underpowered voice barely a whisper.
"And I want everything you have on the engineer."
"You can have the information on Jordan."
"I want it all. And if I have to go to Canaris, I'll do it."
"Oh, for Christ's sake, Kurt. You're not going to go running to Uncle Willy, are you?"
Fogel stood and buttoned his jacket.
"I want his name, and I want his file."
He turned and walked out of the office.
"Kurt, come back here,"
Müller called out.
"Let's work this out. Jesus Christ."
"If you want to talk, I'll be in the old man's office,"
Fogel said as he walked down the narrow hallway.
"All right, you win."
Müller's doughy hands were digging in a cabinet.
"Here's the fucking file. You don't have to run to Uncle Willy again. Jesus Christ, you're worse than the fucking Nazis sometimes."
Fogel spent the rest of the morning reading about Peter Jordan. When he finished, he removed a pair of files from one of his cabinets, returned to his desk, and read them carefully. The first file contained information on an Irishman who had worked as a spy for a short time, but was cut loose because his information was poor. Fogel had taken possession of his dossier and placed him on the V-chain payroll. Fogel was not concerned with the bad reviews the spy had received in the past. He was not looking for a spy. There were other qualities about the agent Fogel found attractive. He worked a small farm on an isolated stretch of Britain's Norfolk coast. It was a perfect safe house, close enough to London to make the journey by train in 3 hours, far enough away so the place wasn't crawling with MI5 officers. The second file contained the dossier of a former Wehrmacht paratrooper who had been barred from jumping because of a head wound. The man had all the qualities Fogel liked: perfect English, an eye for detail, a cool intelligence. Ulbricht had found him at an Abwehr wireless listening post in northern France. Fogel placed him on the V-chain payroll and tucked him away for the right assignment. Fogel pushed the files aside and drafted 2 messages. He added the ciphers to be used, the frequencies at which the messages were to be sent, and the transmission schedule. Then he looked up and called for Ulbricht.
"Yes, Herr Captain,"
Ulbricht said. He entered the office, limping heavily on his wooden leg. Fogel looked at Ulbricht an instant before speaking, wondering if the man was up to the demands of an operation like the one he was about to launch. Ulbricht was 27 years old, but looked at least 40. His close-cropped black hair was flecked with grey. Pain lines ran like tributaries from the edge of his one good eye. The second eye had been lost in the explosion. The empty socket was hidden behind a neat black patch. A knight's cross dangled at his throat. The top button of Ulbricht's tunic was undone because the exertion of the most simple movements caused him to become overheated and perspire. In all the time they had worked together, Fogel had never once heard Ulbricht complain.
"I want you to go to Hamburg tomorrow night."
He handed Ulbricht the transcripts of the messages.
"Stand over the radio operator while he sends these. Make certain there are no mistakes. See that the acknowledgements from the agents are in order. If there is anything out of the ordinary, I want to know about it. Understood?"
"Yes, sir."
"Before you go, I want you to track down Horst Neumann."
"He's in Berlin, I believe."
"Where is he staying?"
"I'm not certain," Ulbricht said, "but I believe there is a woman involved."
"There usually is."
Fogel walked to the window and looked out.
"Contact the staff at the Dahlem farm. Tell them to expect us tonight. I want you to join us there when you return from Hamburg tomorrow. Tell them we'll be there for a week. We have a lot to go over. And tell them to rig the jump platform in the barn. It's been a long time since Neumann jumped from an airplane. He'll need practice."
"Yes, sir."
Ulbricht went out, leaving Fogel alone in the office. He stood at the window for a long time, thinking it through once more. The most closely guarded secret of the war, and he planned to steal it with a woman, a cripple, a grounded paratrooper, and a British traitor. "Quite a team you've assembled, Kurt, old man." If his own ass wasn't on the line, he might have found the whole thing funny. Instead, he just stood there like a statue, watching snow drifting silently over Berlin, worrying himself to death.